I'm Dudley Abernathy. And it's a bit of a bugger sitting here when there's been a speaker first and then there's been a lot of stuff going on, because it gives you time to either fall asleep or get scared. And I don't know where to start. I'm going to start by saying on August the 5th I'll be 30 years clean. In Narcotics Anonymous. And I never like to forget the first time I was in a hotel in Miami Beach working, and my old lady had already started changing her hairstyle and her clothes without consulting me, and had just had an affair with another geezer about finished a week before, and so I knew the game was up. And the second family I'd blown through using, and I went down on my knees, and I have to declare I'm an atheist, but I went down on my knees and I asked for help, and I'll never forget it. It was in a really shitty hotel with a concrete floor and a very thin carpet, all covered in stuff that you didn't really like to think too much about. And I asked for help, and I got it very quickly. And by a curious coincidence, somebody I was working with was chatting up a girl in the hotel bar, in the hotel pool. And he thought if he could get some booze down her or a joint in her hand or something, that he's more likely to get his leg over. And she kept refusing. And finally she said that she was in the fellowship. And he knew that I'd been struggling in what I called the Mother Fellowship, because there was no NA in England at the time. And he mentioned it to her, and she called me. And so within a day of me going on my knees, I was at an NA meeting. It was extraordinary. Because I'd never considered myself an addict. I just used. You know. I'd never given myself such a glamorous kind of label. Because what I was doing was very, very boring. And very mundane and very banal. And, you know, that definition of madness of doing the same thing, repeating the same process, expecting a different result. It had been going on for 13 years. And before that, I'd had 10 years of chronic alcoholism. So I was pretty used to it all by then. But I came into my first meeting in Narcotics Anonymous in Biscayne Boulevard. There was a clubhouse in those days in Miami City. And it was a room about this size, with maybe a quarter of the amount of people, or even less. But the moment I walked in, I felt at home. Felt completely at home. And they showed me the pamphlets that are on the table now. There wasn't a recovery text in those days. There wasn't the little white book and a few pamphlets, maybe about four. And I looked at one of the pamphlets, and it described me. And I burst into tears, because I did not believe that anybody else knew what it felt like inside my desolate head and heart, my dried up cold heart. I didn't know that anybody understood what it was to hand your will and your life over to drugs. I didn't know the lovelessness of it and the despair of it. I had babies and I was indifferent to them. The one side of me, the very strong side of me, was indifferent to them, and yet crying out somewhere inside, tiny little voice, was yearning to love those babies. You know, really yearning, and finding it very difficult. And one of the saddest things was when the babies were a little older. We split up, but I've always been an honourable father. I've always turned up. I come from a broken home, and my mother never turned up. And I was determined that if I said to the kids, I'd be there, come hell or high water. And I remember once being with the children when they were very young, and they came up with one of their games to play. and I couldn't play. I couldn't play with them. I couldn't get out of my head enough to play some simple game of snakes and ladders or something. I mean, this is a poverty-stricken existence. I'm sorry. And when I tell you that 18 months ago, my daughter rang me up and she said, "Dad, I'm having a baby. You were there helping when I was born in your back room. Can I come and have my baby in your back room? And will you be there?" You know. Now, I don't know whether anybody can give, any girl can give their father a better example of trust and love than that. You know. And I was there when my granddaughter was born. My relationships, I'm getting very muddled. It's no good trying to be linear in this game, you know. I can't do it. What do I want to say? I want to say that when I came into NA, I thought I wanted to be very, very rich. I wanted to have tons of hookers. I wanted to have tons of drugs. I wanted to have the medical backup to use. I wanted to be taught how to use. I wanted to have a big Rolls Royce with shaded windows like John Lennon. And I could send it on the CND marches and I didn't even have to turn up. I wanted to be like that. And I wanted to be very powerful and have tons and tons of drugs and tons of power over other people and a lot of fame. And I found that that's not me. And the transition was very painful. The transition was very painful. In 1964, 65, I was a kind of movie star, Monquet. That's French for about to be, but fucked up. And a lot of the fucking up happened within a mile of this place. Whenever I got anywhere near any kind of success, I'd blow it. And the last time it happened, I OD'd, and not very far from here, and very, very, very nearly died. My brain had stopped, you know, and it was very dodgy. My only feeling following that was fuck 'em. You know, I was such a genius and such a sensitive artist that nobody understood me. So how could they, you know, how could they understand me? No wonder I'd try and kill myself, you know. I mean, this kind of twisted mind. Today, I'm myself. I am me. Today, I love my kids. I can stand my ex-wife. I'm very glad I don't live with her, but we're good friends. I'm very glad I don't live with either of them, actually. But I have the most wonderful relationship with my children, and I have a good, decent relationship with people. I'm an honest man today. Things that began to come back to me in early recovery, and it wasn't easy. It isn't easy. It is simple, but I don't think it is easy. I came in, there were five of us at the beginning, and we were all new. I think I was the longest clean because I've been hanging around for a year. But we were all new, and you can imagine, we wrapped five or seven newcomers in a room, you know. I mean, how we didn't kill each other, I don't know. You know, because we had to be right. All of us had to be right. I had to be right with such a kind of relentless fury. You know, the bloke said to me, "All you're interested in is scoring points." And I knew he was right. And I remember hearing somebody say, "Which would you sooner be, happy or right?" You know, and at that time, right. You know. I don't know what it is. It's kind of... Sometimes I think that addiction is no more complicated than everything is immediately upside down. So what is good is bad, and what is bad is good. What is honest is dishonest, and what is dishonest is... And it's as simple as that. And that addiction makes me chase as far away from my true self as I can possibly go. And recovery makes me look for it and accept it. And it's hard at first. And then it's incredibly rewarding and incredibly revealing. I now do things that I wouldn't have dreamt that I would do. I do a lot of artistic, creative work. I make comedy, I make songs, I make political songs, I play them, I do a lot of things like that. I play Glastonbury and the Edinburgh Festival and places like that. I mean, they talk about beyond your wildest dreams, and they're beyond even my most boring dreams. You know, I thought I wanted something very different. I can honestly say that 80-90% of the time I am very content. I live alone, which I didn't think I wanted to do. I pad around in my flat, work. I've just started making films as well, with a little camera. I'm very much in touch with all the things I want to do and never could do. In fact, one way of describing me, I suppose, would be that I now do the things that I used to fantasize and resent other people for doing, you know, which is a very different thing. All that kind of repressed ambition and sitting in my chair. Somebody asked me today, about the hippie trail. So, you know, I'm 75 this year. I was a hippie. I wasn't a hard street junkie in Piccadilly. I was a hippie. And in early NA, I had to keep dead quiet about that. Because unless you were actually a hard street junkie, they wouldn't talk to you. You know. So I just stormed it, you know. I just kept quiet. Because I wanted recovery much more than I wanted acceptance from fellow members, from fellow addicts. I wasn't interested in pleasing people. You know, I came in off the street and used the rooms for a long time. Then there began to be a kind of faction in NA where it was kind of cool to have come in off the street. And it was kind of a square to have gone to treatment. And after 12 years in recovery, I was standing at a bus stop up St. Martin's Lane, Charing Cross Road, raging. Standing at night time at this bus stop, absolutely raging. After 12 years in recovery, I was irritable all the time. I was impatient, intolerant, irritable. And I thought, is this what it is? Is this the deal after 12 years? And I knew a guy who had been raging and had lost it. And I said to myself, well, I'll go and ask him how he did it. And whatever it is in the way that we do things in recovery, I will follow. I will do that. And I went to see him. I said, how did you lose this anger? He said, I went into a treatment centre in Weston-super-Mare, a rather low-profile one, not one of those swanky jobs. Because I didn't want to wash Elizabeth Taylor's fucking drinking cup or any, or marry the wretched woman. I didn't want any of that. I wanted to be... And I like this description of me, I'm just another boring addict. And I need that. I've got a rotten ego. It's a sick ego if I let it. But I went into this place and I did 11 weeks primary treatment after 12 years in recovery. And there was a faction within the fellowship that would not speak to me after that. For quite a long time, serious. And it was very, very painful. Because if there's shit in here, what the hell, where the hell do we go? If there's going to be people laying crap on you in the fellowship, where the fuck are you going to go? I expected the buck to stop here. I expected NA to be above that sort of thing. And I never bought into that. I'm prepared to go to any lengths to recover. And I certainly don't intend to please you. In the way that I do it, you know. And it was the second best decision I ever made. I did 11 weeks, and what I discovered was that I hadn't been doing the steps thoroughly enough, properly enough. And you're talking to Mr. N.A. I was on committees. I was on, you know, I was doing all the spiel and all the stuff, and even going around the world for a short while, till there was a danger of becoming a kind of circuit speaker. Then I put the knockers on that. You know, I did two conventions, that's right. And they asked me to do another one, I said no. But, you know, so it's very easy. And the other thing that I suffered from, and I warn fellow members about this, service junkiedom, service addiction. do too much service and you start wanting people to sit down when they're standing up, or you wanted them to shut up when they're talking or talk when they're not, and you would think, you begin to think you know something. I was sitting in a service first service convention we had in London at Imperial College, and I was sitting there and I could hear myself interfering with every single fucking paragraph of whatever was being discussed. This twat was just sitting there mouthing on, and I'm sitting looking and saying, why don't you shut up? And past myself I could see my bike leaning against the wall. Eventually I just got up and I got on my bike and I rode away, and I went to the Mother Fellowship for 3 months. I didn't come back to NA for 3 months, and when I came back it had grown enormously without any input from me. So I went back to doing tea, doing chairs, doing that kind of stuff. I'm not, you know, service is dangerous. Service is dangerous. It is dangerous because you can start to think you know something. And if you think you know something in this world, I think you're lost. I'm lucky because I don't know anything. You know, I really don't. All I see about me is the fellowship growing and flourishing and continuing to do what we do best, is saving life. And I don't have to be right anymore. And it's such a relief. I suffered tremendously when I came in with professional jealousy. Because in order to recover, I had to give up a lot. And I saw my contemporaries, those who didn't use, the ones who were using it, all dead. But the ones who were still alive were flourishing and making great careers for themselves, and I had to give that up. And I did suffer from a lot of, I suffered, every relationship I had, I suffered from jealousy. You just had to look at another bloke, and I was sick. And it was, I don't know where it came from. I think it's part of addiction. I don't know where it came from. It took me completely by surprise. The first girlfriend I ever had, in came jealousy with it. And it's about the most unproductive, stupid, humiliating emotion. And to me, it's all part of it. It's all part of emotional unmanageability and madness. You know, that has gone. You know, the need to control somebody. I found that a lot of the disease in me was the need to control other people. And I mean, you know what happens? We give up drugs, and we go into life in recovery, thank God, with the help and the encouragement and the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. But now we're faced with all the shit that we were faced with before, but we've got no chemicals to damp it down. And it was very, very tough. Very tough. It nearly brought me to my knees. This was before I went into treatment. I don't want to go on about what I do for a living, but I had prayed for a specific thing I wanted to do. I wanted to play the lead in Elizabethan drama in a biggish theatre. Because in my disease, in my sickness, I'd lost my voice. And if you lose your voice, you have no faith. You know, I'd lost my trust. And I got this gig, and I went up to Edinburgh, and I had to face the terror that 15 years or 16 years before that had driven me to ODing down the road. I took an overdose just before I was due to do something in one of the theatres, and I had to face this whole stuff all over again with no medication whatever, and it was terrifying. And in Edinburgh in those days, there was only one place of entertainment, that was pubs. And I had to keep away from that, and I had to keep away from addicts. There were a lot of addicts around on the street. And I managed, with the help of sponsor and the help of the telephone, to just get through it. I would stagger into even half a meeting than no meeting at all. I could just about get through the day. The rehearsals went on for 3 weeks. I could just about get through the day. I couldn't sleep. I'd go to sleep about 11 o'clock at night and then wake up at 4 a.m. every morning relentlessly. You know, it was hell. But I hung on like grim death and got through it. And my sponsor at the end said, well, you're tempered steel now. And he was right. From that day to this, I have been tempered steel. I have not had that fear. I have not had that need to medicate, need to use. I can face anything with comparatively much ease. I know that I can deal with anything that comes my way with the help of Narcotics Anonymous and the involvement in the fellowship and the involvement in the program. I know that I am impregnable, makes it sound wrong, but I am capable. I'm able. I'm able to love. I'm able to work. I'm able to be kind. I'm able to deal with sickness. Recently, over Christmas and New Year, I was in hospital. I went to the hospital and then I came out and then I had to go back in again. I had a poisoned gallbladder, which was pretty nasty, and it had to come out. And that was cool. That was cool. And 9 years ago, I had a heart attack and a double bypass. That was cool. That was cool. And the extraordinary thing about those times is both times they've involved serious pain-killing drugs, and both times, neither of those times did the drugs present themselves to me as anything other than pain management. It was quite extraordinary. Mind you, I'd had a good 20 years or 15 to 20 years recovery by then. This just didn't interest me. They didn't come knocking and say, hey, remember us? At all. They just said, this is what you do to deal with the pain. You know. And the only times I said that I didn't want DF-118 when I came out, because I used to be a bit keen on DFs. You know. There was a bent Chinese chemist on Shaftesbury Avenue that used to... It's amazing how you find all this stuff, isn't it? I wouldn't know now. I wouldn't honestly know where to score. I don't know. I'm just not interested. I'm not interested. I mean, to have a mind, an imagination, and an intelligence that's awake and alert and creative, rather than to have a dulled, vicious, suspicious, mean-spirited... You know, people say, don't you ever miss it? No. What? Miss what? You know, kind of living death. But cool. Cool. Fuck off. Terminal cool. Jesus. I settled for so little. When I was using so little, sold myself so short, gave people around me just a shit deal, you know. And then along comes recovery, you take the lid off it, you look at it, you get the strength and you deal with it, and it becomes sweet. And you find, I found that what I aspired to when I was young, you know, when you're about 12 or 14, you start looking at the behavior of grown-ups and you think, Jesus, I'm never going to do that. And then you find you do all of them. They're almost like signals to get into the harbor. You have to cheat on your wife. You have to do all this kind of stuff, whatever it was. You know, whatever it was I found offensive, I had to do. And then the kind of... Maybe it's a kind of innocence that was there all the time. I think most addicts that I've come across over the years in recovery, I think we share one quality which is extraordinary, which is, it seems to me that we share a common spiritual yearning. It's odd. It's nothing to do with religion. Thank whoever you thank. I nearly said it. But it is true. I believe it's true. I believe, I know that I didn't recognize it, but I had underneath it a yearning to live a good life. Not moral, but just a good life. A life that cares about other human beings and it gives a damn. You know, and to be offered, after all this bad behavior and all this sort of stupidity and madness, to be offered a chance as I say, to help save life is not a bad thing. And it's better than vanities and hierarchies and jostling for positions within the fellowship. I love that, as long as everything that unites us is stronger than what would drive us apart. I love certain expressions I love in NA. I love anonymity as the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, and ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. It's a wonderful thing to say. I used to fancy myself a bit of a student of philosophy. I like reading philosophy. I turned into comedy nowadays. But it was good. And the NA, the traditions inherited from the Mother Fellowship, I call it the Mother Fellowship because I think to call it the Other Fellowship is demeaning. We don't want to demean our mother. I don't buy into this anti-AA trip. I don't buy into jokes about bedwetting and red noses. I think it's demeaning, and I think we're bigger than that. For Christ's sake, we're better than that, you know. But I do think that the traditions of our fellowships are probably amongst some of the most important philosophical writing in the 20th and 21st century. If one looks at it, they're extraordinary. And they're like hewn in stone. I know, because when the five or seven of us used to try and attack each other, we always went back to the traditions. And the traditions were always there, and we never found them wanting. It was extraordinary. I remember the terror. I was, because I brought some pamphlets over from the States, I was going to be the secretary. And then I didn't want to do that because somebody else did it. So I was going to do the teas. And I stayed away all night because I was in a panic because I thought I didn't know how to make Nescafe. Do you remember that feeling when tiny little jobs were monumental tasks that filled you with terror? And you didn't know how was I going to find a nail to fix that window? Do you remember those, you know, how we used to lug everything, lug 15 tons of worry about. It's a shit deal. Drugs is a shit deal. And yet I fell for it. I thought it was amazing. I thought I was so much superior to everybody that wasn't using these people called squares. You know, the squares. And you know that thing, I used to hang out in hippie communes, you know. You go to a hippie commune, the first thing you do is freak out all the neighbours so they don't come bursting in when you're at it. So you're rude to them and nasty, and so they don't come in. Then you spend the rest of the time complaining that they're unfriendly. It's sort of so small-minded. I used to look at it sometimes and think, this is really such shit. Why am I buying into it? You know, I bought into a lot of nonsense when I was using a lot, and spouted a lot of nonsense, you know, and expected to be treated with some kind of respect. Kind of nonsense. I don't know. I'm beginning to ramble now. We've got another fucking 20 minutes. Can't somebody else say anything? What can I say? Got another 20 minutes. 10 minutes. Oh well, that's not too bad. Another 10. Yeah, it is odd, isn't it? Because what I expected when I came in is so very different from, you know, what I thought I wanted is so very different from what I know now I want, and it had to be shown to me. I had to be led by the hand, and that's one of the biggest surprises of all in recovery. And it continues. It's not something that stops. You know, my spiritual understanding is very much to do with ego loss. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, the power greater than myself is about ego loss. You know, and that was a very hard thing to come to terms with. I had an example of it. I had this heart attack. I was lying in the hospital. And I woke up and they were going boom, boom with that machine that they do, you see on the medical programs on telly. And I thought, this is amazing. And I looked around, there was a circle of people around the bend. It was going boom, boom. And I was looking. And this is only 8 years ago, and I thought, well, I'm either going to be alive or I'm not going to be alive. But either is going to be really interesting. You know, it's peculiar. I had that, you know, when you're on a jet plane and it's dawn and you see that string of light. And that's what it was like. And it was, I mean, it was cool, is what I'm saying. It was cool. And I trusted it. And I've been reading a Buddhist book rather a lot at the time, you know. And I just trusted it. Was the right, I mean, well, I mean, it is utter powerlessness. And the extraordinary thing about powerlessness is it's incredibly powerful. And that is a Buddhist kind of attitude, I think. I don't know. But it's certainly a paradox, but it is true. It is incredibly empowering to be powerless, to have no lean on anything, to have no expectations of anything. It's incredibly empowering. You know, and I went through this operation, and I dealt with that by asking the surgeon to tell me everything. And it was fascinating, because what they do is they get a circular saw and they cut open your breastbone. You know, you're going, you're kidding. And then they open it. You know? And I'm saying, well, tell me what. He said, well, then we take your heart out. I said, yeah. Then we wrap it in ice. I said, yeah. And then it stops. I said, yeah, go on. Then we snip it off and we plug you into this Dr. Christian Barnard's heart machine. Well, I'm old enough to remember when there was a terrible fuss, all the churches were raging against Dr. Christian Barnard, this South African surgeon who had invented this heart machine. And then they plug the heart machine, and then they repair the heart. And then I said, then what do you do? He said, well, we warm it up. We plug it back and warm it up. And what happens if it doesn't stop beating? He said, we give it a bit of that, he says. And then he says, we whack it with the thing again. And then we sew it all up and Bob's your auntie, you know. And I mean, it was the curiosity and the excitement and the interest in it that conquered the fear. It was most bizarre. And the only time I got a bit nervous was the night before the operation. This African nun turns up, who I'd seen on the streets around Chelsea. She turns up and says, would you like me to pray for you? You know, the lovely deep voice, you know. Would you like me to pray with you? I thought, well, you know, yeah, okay. And she took my hands, very cool hands, and she made some simple prayers. She believed in it a lot. I fell asleep like a baby. And I woke up and it had all been done. You know, I mean, that's acceptance. That is acceptance. And in my view, it's not just a funny story, or it's not demonstrating anything that I'm either brave, which I'm not, but it's an acceptance. And if one can achieve ego loss and acceptance, it's immensely empowering. You know, and I came out of there, I've just been given the hand. It means 5 minutes. This is countdown time. But I've given a new lease. And the thing is, my daughter came and picked me up and drove down the motorway to go to the country and stay with some friends, and there was a traffic jam, and I started going ballistic. And she said, Dad, she said, not road rage. She said, I thought it was all cool now. You know, and I suddenly saw, and I suddenly thought, now stop it, this is old behaviour. And you know, I haven't had road rage since. Not since. And I was filled with it. I was the one that was giving it that all the time, you know. You know. Bloke came up to me once with a tyre lever. I was terrified. Because I couldn't punch pussy, you know. Couldn't punch my way out of a paper bag. So that's what I've found in NA. I have found a freedom from the ego, a freedom, ego loss, a freedom, powerlessness, the power of powerlessness, and the content, and the glorious riches of finding what I really want for me. And it's much simpler and much more rewarding. And there we are. That's it. That's all you get.